Sheffield Live, made in Sheffield, made by you.
Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. If your business has financial challenges requiring professional insights and solutions, Begbies Trainer can help. We provide advice designed to help people and companies deal successfully with debt and financial problems. And wherever possible, we will find the best solution that allows for active steps towards financial recovery. Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. We're committed to providing a rapid and responsive service based on in-depth experience, professionalism and independent specialist expertise. Contact our Sheffield office on 0114 285 9500 or visit begbies-trainergroup.com.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock on Friday, the 31st of July, 2015. My name's Jamie Veitch. I'm your presenter for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. We are broadcasting on 93.2 FM and from sheffieldlive.org. And this show will also be available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. Most weeks, as you know, this show goes out live, but today's show was pre-recorded on Thursday, the 30th of July, and includes interviews recorded this week with Andy Hanselman and last week at the NatWest SE100 Leaders event, a really interesting event for leaders of social enterprises. And you'll be able to hear some great interviews with really interesting folk who attended that event in today's programme. These include Charlotte Borgia, the Communications Director of Divine Chocolate Limited, Penny Hughes, who chairs the Sustainable Banking Committee at RBS, but who's also worked at Coca-Cola, Vodafone, British Museum and many more corporate businesses. She's going to talk about what social enterprises can learn from corporate and values in traditional businesses. We also hear from Baroness Sue Campbell today. We'll hear from her about leadership. And we will also talk in today's programme with Amy Anslow, co-founder of a social enterprise supermarket, and with Josh Littlejohn of Social Bite. Josh is an entrepreneur bitten by the social enterprise bug. Turning though, first of all, to our first guest of today, it's Andy Hanselman, Sheffield's very own Andy Hanselman. Andy and Jill White have written a great book. We're going to hear about that now. So how do winning businesses get ahead and stay ahead of their competitors? They're dramatically and demonstrably different from their competitors. They do things their competitors don't do, can't do or won't do. We've spoken before about this with Andy Hanselman. Andy, with Jill White, is the author of Think in 3D, the 7 characteristics of dramatically and demonstrably different businesses. Andy is joining me now. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
So, you've been on Sheffield Live, you've been on Business Live with me before. Thanks for coming back. We've talked about the book back in December, your book, Think in 3D. And I'm going to enjoy keeping on saying the 7 characteristics of dramatically and demonstrably different businesses. In fact, dramatically and demonstrably different radio presenters mangle their words, I think.
That's the best way to do it, James. Best way to do it.
So, thanks for coming back on. Now, back in December, your book was launched. There was a lovely event. We interviewed you. We interviewed some other businesses who've been case studies in the book. But now, 3rd of August marks a new exciting stage in the book's iteration.
It is indeed. We're getting all modern. And we've actually got it up on Amazon as a paperback for people to order. But we've also got the Kindle version, which is all very exciting. It's been a big learning experience. So it's up there on August the 3rd for people to download. But special little deal for people who are listening to Sheffield Live. If they actually go on Kindle now or go on Amazon now or tomorrow, they can actually get it for free.
Indeed. So today, Friday the 31st of July, and tomorrow, Saturday the 1st of August, you can actually download this book for free as a Kindle download from Amazon.
That's right, yes.
So we've brought you on to talk about that because Okay. Obviously this is really worth doing. If Sure. You're running a business and if you want to be a great business, if you want to be a successful business, if you want to be a different business, Yep. It's really worth getting this book. And to be quite honest, it's a no-brainer. You can download it for free. But let's give people a bit of a whet their appetite in terms of what's in the book.
Sure.
I bought a copy myself, of course, back in December, and I recommend it. But resonating with other topics in today's show, we've talked about, obviously, the characteristics of dramatically and demonstrably different businesses. But you've got practical steps in the book about improving business competitiveness, competence and culture. And I just wanted to talk a little bit, first of all, about leaders. So there are five key things that you talk about within the book in terms of what business leaders could be, should be, and what people, staff, want leaders to be. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, absolutely. We've identified seven characteristics. I think the first thing just to stress is it's not do these 25 things and all be multimillionaires overnight.
No.
It's seven key things that we see successful businesses do. And one of them is get that vision thing. And I think one of the key roles of leaders is to get this picture of where their business, where their organisation is going, or even where their team or department is going. I think, again, we've seen 3D businesses that leadership is created at every level. So it's having this vision of where we're going. And I think what we see in the 3D leadership is that they paint this picture that stimulates, excites, inspires people. And it's not just a set of figures. One of the things I often say is that we didn't actually sort of see when we were talking about 1962, Martin Luther King standing on Capitol Hill saying, "I've got a strategic business plan and a cash flow forecast." He had a dream. And I'm not saying everybody has to have a dream, but it is this thing that says, if you were sat here in 12 months' time, what would be in place? What would it look like? And that's not just about the numbers, it's about the people, it's about customers. And certainly somebody starting out in business could be, what are you doing differently as an individual? But then I think one of the things that we really see leaders do very, very well is that they engage people and get other people to buy into that. And that could be their team, but I think, again, it's worth pointing out that it could be suppliers, it could be other people that could help you get to where you want to get to. So we sort of suggest that what we see leaders do is that they share the vision and not necessarily give away company secrets, but they get people to buy into it and help get people to help them move things forward. And I think the other thing that we see in the leaders is they actually then make sure that that vision drives what they do.
Yes.
So it helps them drive things forward. So it's a destination.
And I think that, as you say, that absolutely resonates with some of the other comments that I've had from other leaders, from social enterprise leaders, and in fact from Baroness Sue Campbell, the former head of UK Sport, in this programme today, talking about vision and talking about engagement as well. So this really does resonate. And I'm really glad that you made the point as well. This isn't a sort of read this book, get rich quick. Absolutely not. Obviously, you've got to do the hard work, the strategic work as well on the business in terms of that thought. But having identified these characteristics and provided real examples of businesses with these characteristics, I found the book practical as well.
That's how we do our work. But one of the things we were very keen to do is to share with people examples, businesses that have done it. So yes, there are examples of Steve Jobs and Google and the top businesses, but also some local, but also just small businesses that are making this stuff happen. Because again, what we see is that the seven characteristics can apply to somebody starting out in business or to already running a large multinational business. Obviously, the impact of what they do and how they do it will shape them and their business to make a difference in terms of the impact they can have directly on their business. But if they can get people to buy into the philosophy of 3D thinking, it actually does help people start to make real improvements in their business.
And buying into that philosophy involves questioning, asking questions yourself, and being prepared to ask other people questions and listen to the answers as well.
Absolutely. And I think there's sort of two key areas there. One of the things that we see 3D businesses do is they spend a lot of time asking and listening to their customers.
Yes.
And I'll keep it there for me is the listening bit. I see lots of people that send forms out, ask people to fill them in, but don't do anything with it. And it's this whole idea of finding out what customers want. But I think the big one for me is how you're performing. What do your customers think you're doing well, not so well? So what we've put in the book is just some very simple questions to create some dialogue with customers. And that could be very, very simple things like, why do you buy from us?
Yeah.
You have to be careful how you ask that one. Why do you buy from us actually can actually undermine what you're doing. But when do you use us? When do you use our competition? A couple of ones for me is this whole idea is, what one thing do we do that irritates or annoys you?
Mm-hmm.
Or what one thing should we never stop? And it's just getting conversations going. We talk about creating dialogue, not diatribes. And it's this thing about questioning customers, but getting feedback back from them. But I think it's the same with employees, asking them. And again, lots of businesses carry out staff attitude surveys. But going back to the leadership thing, there's a little tool that we encourage our clients to use, and we use it on our programs, called Stop, Start, Continue.
Yes.
And we get, it can be a simple form or a conversation that says, get your team to tell you what you as a leader should stop doing, start doing, continue doing. And it's just a way of just trying to sort of get a picture of what's going on. You've got to be careful. I had one client who did this, and one of his staff wrote, stop breathing, which is not the most constructive way of doing it.
Not...
But it's about creating conversations and trying to remove some of your own blind spots.
Yeah, indeed. And perhaps that has started a dialogue in that particular example that needed to be had.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So really, really useful stuff in here. And as we've said, the book is available free as a download today, Friday, and tomorrow, Saturday, on Amazon as a Kindle download. Easy to find. But, of course, you can also buy the book in paperback from Amazon or from your website. Now, the book has been out since December. You've sold over 1,000
copies? Over 1,000 copies. We've just got a second print run going. We got the first one done. We've self-published it.
Yeah.
And we've done it, and we're now looking at setting another run to start getting it out again as we sort of do this second launch.
So on the basis of following the advice that you've given in the book, I have to ask you then, Andy, what sort of response have you had from people? What have people loved about the book? And what have people said? Have people sort of questioned anything in the book? You know, is there anything that you've thought, oh, yeah, people want more information about this, so the next book will be about whatever?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the feedback I've had have been fantastic, which is great. And people said they've liked the practical examples and things that they can actually go away and do. It, you know, it's not full of academic theories or magic answers, if there is such a thing. People like that. But certainly one of the things that we're seeing already, people are saying, could you tell us a bit more, particularly around things like creating and shaping the culture of a business. Characteristic 5, what we call Uber culture, and everybody understands what's expected of them. The systems are built to reinforce it. People are empowered to actually deliver these things, and they're rewarded for doing it. That's what Uber stands for.
Mm.
We work with quite a few clients in terms of implementing this in their business. And I think already one of the things we're seeing is that maybe that could be the next book to develop that even further. And equally, another one is, you were talking on earlier, the seven, again, we've identified 8 things that 3D leaders do. And again, that could be an extension and developing that in the future. But at the moment, we're focusing on this and getting it out there rather than dashing onto other things.
Yeah.
Other thing that we're just looking at doing, which will be, again, out soon, is an online diagnostic tool where people can actually diagnose their business against the 7 characteristics. And again, it'll link into the book. So we're hoping to develop that relatively shortly.
Lovely. Well, thoroughly recommend downloading the book today or tomorrow. You've got today and tomorrow only to download it for free. Of course, you can buy it. You can buy it in paperback. You can then buy it after the free download has ended on Amazon. It's really easy to find. Think in 3D, the 7 characteristics of dramatically and demonstrably different businesses. Look it up, Andy Hanselman and Jill White. You'll find it on Amazon. Of course, you can also find Andy on your website. Andy, do you want to give out the address?
Yes, it's very imaginatively titled, andyhanselman.com. And again, if people are interested, they can sign up to 3D Thoughts, which is a very short weekly podcast that we do that shares some of these ideas that we talk about.
Superb. Andy, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much indeed.
We're open for Business Live.
You're listening to Business Live with me, Jamie Veitch. We're broadcasting on FM radio, online and as a podcast. Now, how do leaders of social enterprises balance the need to create a surplus with the need to create social impact? Well, an interesting question, and one described as somewhat akin to alchemy. Last Thursday and Friday, I went along to a really interesting conference, the NatWest SE 100 Insight event, focusing on leadership with purpose. It took place in Edinburgh, and about 50 really inspirational social enterprise leaders came along to talk, to learn from one another, and to hear from great speakers, including Baroness Campbell, who's run UK Sport and talked about translating some of her lessons and experiences into practical things that social enterprise leaders should do. Now, we have an interview with Sue coming up, but we also have interviews with other participants at the event, with Amy Anslow, who co-founded social enterprise supermarket Hisby. You'll hear from Amy later on. With Charlotte Borger, the communications director of Divine Chocolate Limited, the farmer-owned fair trade chocolate company, which has grown to turning over £8 million in the UK alone. Also speaking at the event and interviewed in this programme was Josh Littlejohn, founder of Social Bite, a high street chain of sandwich shops throughout Scotland that donates 100% of profits to good causes and employs people from homeless backgrounds. Josh also was the founder of the Scottish Business Awards. He's brought President Bill Clinton, Sir Richard Branson and Bob Geldof to Scotland to speak and help to fundraise. We're going to hear from Josh later on about how he was bitten by the social enterprise bug. So an excellent event, crammed with inspiration, genuine inspiration from inspirational people, and run with the support of NatWest and RBS. So let's turn to our first interviewee, Baroness Sue Campbell. Sue trained as a physical education teacher. She taught in Manchester and she lectured at Leicester and Loughborough universities. She represented her country as a player, a coach and a team manager. She then worked for the Sports Council, National Coaching Foundation. She became chief executive there, then became chief executive of the Youth Sport Trust. In April 2005, she was appointed as chair for UK Sport. And she ran the organisation until April 2013. She presided over Team GB and Paralympic GB's largest medal haul in living memory. She has some really interesting lessons for social enterprises. Let's hear from Sue.
Okay, I'm Baroness Sue Campbell. I am presently the chair of the Youth Sport Trust, but for 10 years was the chair of UK Sport between 2003 and 2013. For me, leadership starts with moral purpose. I think to create a really strong business, you need to really keep innovation moving forward all the time, never being satisfied with searching out new solutions. And as a leader, you need to know your own strengths. You also need to know your own areas of development, and you need to put strong people around you who make your team complete. In other words, not to be frightened of putting strong people against those areas that you're not particularly strong in.
Baroness Sue Campbell there at the NatWest SE100 Insight event. And of course, in her presentation, Sue talked about incremental gains. We've heard a lot about that from the world of sport. They can be applied to business and to social enterprise too. Now, one of the people at the event, participant who I spoke to, who was enthused and inspired by Sue, is Dana Siegel of Cockpit Arts.
So my name is Dana Siegel. I'm the Development and Events Manager for Cockpit Arts. Cockpit is a social enterprise based in London. I've got an arts fundraising background, and I made the move to work for Cockpit because I was really interested in the idea of social enterprise, really interested in sustainable business models for the arts, and I wanted to not only develop my own skills, but also work for an organisation that does something that I believe in very strongly, which is about allowing people who are creative and talented to earn a sustainable living out of what they do.
And what have you learnt or heard that's been particularly useful at this SE100 event so far?
That's interesting. Well, I mean, the talk that we just came out of was extremely inspiring. Sue is a really, really amazing woman. I think a lot of it is much more around the thinking about the things that drive us to do what we do and making sure that we always maintain that balance between running a business but also fulfilling that social purpose and constantly reevaluating the why. Are we doing this why? You know, I think that's a big, big question for me, and if that's something that I can implement in my day-to-day practice and improve 0.01% every day, then overall that should be something that will help Cockpit and myself in the long term.
Dana Siegel there from Cockpit Arts at the NatWest SE100 Insight event. I mentioned Josh Littlejohn earlier on. Josh founded Social Bite, a high street chain of sandwich shops throughout Scotland that donates 100% of profits to good causes. Let's hear from Josh.
My name's Josh Littlejohn from Social Bite.
Social Bite, where did the inspiration come from, first of all?
Back in 2011, I read a book by a guy called Professor Muhammad Yunus, and in that book he talks about how in Bangladesh he's created over 50 different companies, and some of them went on to become billion-dollar businesses, but he never owned a single share in one of them. Every single business was about creating, tackling a social problem in Bangladesh. So I thought that was a really inspiring idea to use business to tackle social challenges. So I went to visit Professor Yunus in Bangladesh. I spent a week there touring his different social businesses, and we were so inspired that I decided to come back to Scotland and set up our own social business, which was a sandwich shop called Social Bite.
And what's been the most challenging part of developing Social Bite?
The most challenging part has been to develop a business that's a really, really good sandwich shop. It's a really good business. It's a good sandwich shop. The products are good. The price are good. Get it, the economics to stack up and get it to make money. You know, before you look at any of the different social aspects of the business, which is employing homeless people and feeding homeless people and donating the profits away, before you take any of those into account, the hardest bit is just simply running a very good, profitable business. So that's been a big learning curve over the last 3 years and something that we've worked really hard to do.
Have you compromised on your social values and your social aim in the pursuit of balancing the books and bringing in the money?
Not really, no. Doing something like, so the way we're structured is 100% of the shares of Social Bite are owned by a parent charity that we set up, which distributes the profits out to good causes that we're really passionate about. So one of the things I'm really dead set on is that we would never sacrifice the purity of that model. So we would never want to give away 5% equity, 10% equity to anyone that was interested in private reward. So certainly the purity of the model is something we've been very focused on. So I'd say that we've achieved what we've achieved over the last 3 years and expanded to different cities whilst maintaining the social mission that was at the heart of it when we started.
And why do your customers buy from you? Is it because of your social mission, or is it because the sandwiches are really, really good? Or is it both?
I think it's primarily both, and I think, you know, what I always say is that you have to get all the fundamentals right first before the social bit even becomes a factor. You know, if our sandwiches aren't really great, not even on a level with our competitors, but we want them to be better, and we have to be priced competitively, we have to offer great value, customer service has to be great, the shops have to be clean, quick service, so all these fundamental things of running a good sandwich business have to be in place. If you can get all those right and you offer a completely social mission that the customers can feel engaged with and take ownership of, then that buys you an added loyalty from those customers, and they'll go away and tell their friends and their work colleagues. So I think get the fundamentals right and the social bit will give you an added bonus.
And you're known in entrepreneurial circles in Scotland for setting up the awards here. What have you learned from other business leaders, and what can you pass on to other social entrepreneurs?
The thing I've kind of learned from other business leaders is that we organise this event called the Scottish Business Awards, and we have about 2,000 really, really influential, wealthy, private sector business leaders in a room every night. And every year I go up and give a speech at that event about social enterprise and Social Bite, and I give that speech maybe about 11 o'clock at night when all these wealthy, influential people are a bit drunk. So that's quite a daunting speech to give. So I'm ultimately giving a speech about why business should be used not just for making money, but a force for good. So I'm always daunted by that, but what amazes me every time is that the overwhelmingly positive reaction I get from all these private sector people. I get floods of emails in after, everyone comes up to me in the night and says, wow, inspiring. So I think sometimes the private sector is kind of bashed a bit and thought of as, you know, money making and one-dimensionally focused on profits, but I think ultimately we're all just human beings, and all of us have altruistic motivations within us. It doesn't matter if you're a millionaire or if you're a guy on the streets, you know, we've all got altruistic motivations within us. So I think the private sector business community can definitely be harnessed to support and also become clients of social enterprises.
Josh Littlejohn, the founder of Social Bite, a high street chain of sandwich shops, speaking to me there at the NatWest SE100 Insight event last week. Josh also founded the Scottish Business Awards. Now, how do social enterprises market themselves? Do you market ethics? Do you market quality? What do people buy? Interesting question. Does marketing ethics, does marketing your social impact actually put off consumers? Well, Charlotte Borger is the communications director of Divine Chocolate Limited. It's the farmer-owned fair trade chocolate company. And Charlotte joined the business in 2003. She gave a presentation at the event. She also spoke with me.
We'll hear the interview with Charlotte now.
I'm Charlotte Borgia from Divine Chocolate.
Charlotte, we're at the SE100 Leaders event in Edinburgh. Your talk this morning went down really, really well. Great feedback. Thank you very much for that. Now, you've talked about your experience of marketing Divine Chocolate. What do you know now? What have you learned over 12 years of your time of marketing Divine in terms of what makes people buy?
Well, obviously, when I first joined, it was very early days for Divine, and we were still absolutely cock-a-hoop about what an amazing story we were and about the farmers who owned the business. And that's what we wanted to tell everyone about. And almost the chocolate was coming second. I don't mean that completely. Obviously, we were making this amazing product, but what we were really talking about was the farmers. And, you know, the big thing that we've learned over time is that even the most dedicated ethical consumer doesn't buy ethics in a wrapper. They want fantastic chocolate. I mean, chocolate is a particular case in point where they want it to be indulgent and lovely. And the farmer's story to an ethical consumer is important, but they're still buying just because they want really fantastic chocolate. And then the wider chocolate-loving market, they just want to know about the chocolate, how fantastic it is. They want to be seduced. The farmer story can be really work well, but after that, after you've won them over on the chocolate.
So it's really, really about products and getting people.
Absolutely. With chocolate, that is so absolutely the case.
And in terms of then putting your brand out there, you're competing with global multinationals with huge marketing budgets. How do you compete in that space?
Well, to be honest, just by being us, you know, we can't bring that kind of money to bear on our marketing. We have to be creative, we have to be a bit naughty sometimes and a bit cheeky, and we have to use social media in a way that only we can, in a way that networks with the sorts of people that support us, that talks with a real authentic voice, and just appealing to people very directly. And the nice thing about Divine is that the person you meet at an exhibition is the person you talk to on the phone, who's probably the person doing the tweeting. They're real people, and I think people really like being able to relate very directly to us and connect very directly with us in the same way as they're enjoying directly having contact with the farmers. I think we're just delivering something that's different, and we'll try and be very loud about that difference in as many ways as we can. And I think our difference comes out.
And you've talked also about collaboration, and collaboration with other social enterprises, and of course being really, really valuable. Some people are scared of that. They think it dilutes them in some way. I mean, what have you learned about collaboration?
We wouldn't be anywhere near where we are now without the collaborations and partnerships that we've done. And we've done a real mix of them. So we're either doing them with other people who absolutely share our values, so other fair trade companies, other social enterprises, where together we can get an economy of scale and we can share resources, but we can also really shout louder about fair trade or about social enterprise. But at the other end of the scale, we're having the opportunity to partner up with extremely big brands that can give us some real punch. And there is an exchange there. They get the value of being associated with an interesting brand that's a bit exclusive. It's an added value to them. And so we both win. I mean, we're obviously careful to a certain extent, and we wouldn't do it with a company who we really had thought we had dodgy values. But, you know, the companies like O2, like Penguin, we've worked with other big brands. There are really nice associations, get us the reach that we want without, I don't think, compromising our values at all.
Quite, indeed. And final question, what's your favourite chocolate bar?
Well, it was the Divine with toffee and sea salt. It's now our most amazing new dark caramel bar. Dark chocolate with a soft caramel centre. Totally palm oil free. Totally delicious. Now in all Oxfams. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing product. We're really proud of it.
Listeners, get out there and taste that. Charlotte, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Plenty of food for thought there, if you'll pardon the pun. That was Charlotte Borgia, Communications Director of Divine Chocolate Limited, speaking with me at the NatWest SE100 Insight event. So, coming along to events like this, how productive is it? How helpful is it? How useful is it to leaders of social enterprises? Well, one such leader is Tony Jones, Let's hear from Tony.
Tony Jones, Chief Executive Officer, Landlife National Wildflower Centre.
Tony, what's been the best thing about the event for you so far?
It's just the energy and enthusiasm that people are demonstrating, the ideas, the imagination. So it's just been fantastic to get away from the office, which I think we all get trapped in occasionally, and just meet other like-minded people that want to drive change in the business world and change in society.
And you're not short of energy and enthusiasm yourself.
I try not to be, yes. I try to be very enthusiastic and energetic all the time, but it's been great to also hear the realistic side of always trying to be an example that it can get. We've heard examples from people saying it can get tiring, stressful, but to always believe in the mission and yourself, to accept that self-doubt will creep in, but not to show people that perhaps you're self-doubtful or you're scared or you're frightened, but you're doing the best you can. And that's been really, really encouraging as well, that people have been very honest about their personal experiences.
That's really helpful, isn't it, in terms of learning from others. Can you tell me in 30 seconds what the Landlife National Wildflower Centre does?
We're about changing people's lives and changing people's landscapes, which was a book by Nan Fairbrother many, many years ago, a landscape architect. But what I mean by that is we use wildflowers to look at what we can do to create new wild spaces for people and for wildlife and involve the community in that process.
And what are you most proud of in what you do and have done?
I think I'm an ecologist, so I'm always proud of the fact that we are positively addressing wildlife, but I'm particularly proud that we do that in a way that involves people and gets them enthused about local wildlife, in our case wildflowers, which obviously brings in wildlife such as bees and beetles and birds and all sorts of things. I'm very pleased that we're re-engaging people in nature, and we're rewilding Britain.
And where does your income come from?
70% of our income at the moment comes from trading. So we have two farms just in St Helens, where we grow and then process wildflowers into seeds. We use those seeds to drive an income for the organisation. And we run the National Wildflower Centre, which is a centre of inspiration, of excellence, of ideas, imagination, fun, excitement, all the things we want wildflowers to be, where you can come along and look at wildflowers growing on weird and wacky substrates such as CDs, crushed CDs, anyone? Crushed concrete tower blocks. And we also have a cafe and conference service, which brings a bit of income. And, of course, being a charity, grants.
Incredible that 70% of income is earned income, you trading.
It is a deliberate policy. The organisation is now 40 years old this year. We've just celebrated that back in May with some fantastic wildflower displays. But the organisation in 1984, so just over 30 years ago, took a deliberate decision that it couldn't just be an ordinary charity at that time and rely on grants, and set up what would now be called a social enterprise. At that time, it was just a trading company to bring in some extra income. It's about driving our primary purpose of improving the British wildlife position and engaging people. So it's amazing. Yes, it is incredible just how much money can be made from seed. How much work goes into producing that seed as well is also incredible. And the lives we've changed as a result.
Your number one top tip then for social enterprise leaders?
My number one top tip is to keep yourself very mission-focused, very value-driven. They're related, obviously. And to ensure that you're clear what you want to do to deliver benefits. My other tip, which is related to that, if I may take this.
We can have two tips.
I thought you could have two
tips. Are good.
They actually are related. I suppose my top tip is that the environmental organisations are about people as well. And it's more of a sector-specific tip, I suppose, in that it's been hearing about people here, and people can pigeonhole wildlife organisations. They're just about wildlife. Actually, we're about people. We're about improving the lives of people as much as we are about wildlife. And I personally don't believe we have a valuable life unless we have access, as we do outside this glorious window, which your listeners won't be able to see now. Look at green and lovely, pleasant lands. It improves our lives.
Tony, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's been great to speak.
Tony Jones there speaking with me at the NatWest SE100 Insight event last week. Now, what can social enterprises learn from big businesses? Well, Penny Hughes, who's the chair of the Sustainable Banking Committee at RBS, was on hand last week at the same event to talk with me. Penny has spent her career at Coca-Cola, she's worked at Vodafone, at Gap, at Reuters, and she's been a trustee of the British Museum, amongst plenty of other work. We'll hear from Penny now.
Good evening, I'm Penny Hughes, non-executive director of RBS and chair of the Sustainable Banking Committee for RBS.
So Penny, thanks for joining me this evening. Really interesting to hear about what social enterprises can learn from big businesses and big brands. And what are the lessons that you could give to social enterprises from your experience of working with people like Vodafone, in businesses like Gap, in businesses like Body Shop and Coca-Cola?
So my experience is all businesses need to have a really clear identity of what their real purpose is and have an understanding of why they're special. And so obviously Coca-Cola has built over 200 years a very special relationship with millions of consumers around the world about being that moment of pleasure, that pause for refreshment. Same with the Body Shop, probably the leading business in terms of profit with principles. And for me, social enterprise does this very well because by their very nature, they have a social purpose and one that is applauded and understood by their customers.
So it's that social purpose is applauded and understood. That is clear and that is embedded in their values. But people won't just buy based on that social purpose as well, will they?
No, that's right. I think any enterprise then needs to absolutely be obsessive about providing a great service or what I call an unstoppable belief in the investment in the consumer. So if you don't deliver great service, great quality, then whatever your purpose, you're unlikely to win. And so for me, many of the rules of social enterprise are the same as in commercial enterprise because you've got to really deliver excellence first. And of course, if you've got a social purpose too, then fantastic. But actually, I don't think a commercial business can operate without a social purpose, without actually being understood and respected in society. And perhaps that's something that banks forgot and are now having to relearn. But if I go back to something like Morrison's, where I'm a director, you know, simply putting great food on the table at a great value for money price for families who can afford through recessionary times is the basic requirement of a major supermarket. So for me, big businesses have to remember at the end of the day, they're serving customers one meal at a time, one drink at a time, one transaction at a time.
And that's interesting as well. Is there a tendency, whatever the business, whether it's large or small, whether it's a social enterprise or a traditional business, sometimes there's a tendency to overcomplicate, isn't there?
Definitely. And so you've got to remember just how simple life needs to be and have a purpose that everyone can understand, whether it be your consumers or your employees or other stakeholders, and something that people can just admire and get. And so if you take something like the Body Shop, you know, customers understand that if you buy a product from the Body Shop, then it's been fairly traded. There's, you know, products have been brought from Trade Not Aid Ventures. If you buy something from Morrison's, you understand the provenance of that. You know, meats come from the farms that Morrison's can know and understand. And so social enterprise, as I say, has that advantage in that you understand that the sort of basic motivation for the business model is to put something back into society. And so that authenticity is really what's so appealing.
Authenticity is something that does, as you say, really appeal to customers and keeps us coming back again and again and again. Mm. You can't fake it, though, can you?
You can't. No, it has to be real. You have to live it. You have to live it from, you know, from top to bottom, left to right, and it just has to be authentic.
But in businesses, again, in businesses, large and small, corporate, social, all sorts, sometimes we have to grapple with reputation management and with winning back trust, whatever we've been through, whatever, you know, whatever the sector. Mm. And how do businesses do that if you know, if they've lost trust or if their sector as a whole has been through a tough time, let's say? How do you go about that?
I think you can only do it by relearning excellence and becoming reliable on an everyday basis. And it's not something you can do from head office. It's not something you can do from the CEO's office. It's something you have to do in the front line every day in every transaction you manage. Tonight we've had a discussion around social enterprise and how pure social enterprises should be. And for me, it's quite a tussle that I have. Probably the business that I've been involved with that has had the greatest social impact in the world is Vodafone. Enabling mobile telephony has changed the world, and yet that's a commercial organization. And so for me, whatever scale of business you're in, there has to be a social purpose and a social benefit. And I've just been lucky to be involved with some really quite special ones.
And we've talked about some of the businesses you've been involved with. You're also a school governor.
Yes.
You also work with the British Museum.
Yes.
And in your career, can you tell us about some of the most inspirational mentors, the people who've helped you, whether it was start of your career, whether it's later, whether it's now? Who's been a real inspiration to you?
So the CEO of Coca-Cola, Don Keough, who was in fact awarded Businessman of the Year 3 times on the run in the USA, which has never been done before and I dare say won't ever be done again, was a fantastic mentor for me. And he enabled me and he gave me the courage and the freedom to really, you know, experiment. I was the first female vice president of the Coca-Cola business and he was very proud of that. But he used to say to me, Penny, we do not sell Coca-Cola globally. We sell Coke one drink at a time. Don't ever forget that. And that's just something that's rested with me. It is every single transaction and every little detail. And being able to satisfy consumers one at a time is really the kind of the depth that's required. I was then very lucky to work with Anita Roddick at the Body Shop. I remember visiting Nepal with her where we were replanting banana trees because we used the banana leaves for the paper that goes around the Body Shop. And she and I, from the small change in our pockets, there is now a Penny and Anita school in Kathmandu. And so there are just moments in life where you realise what the purpose of using your own skill, your own network, your own just sense of community can actually make a difference. So I've been very lucky. I have some great mentors. And I suppose also at The Gap, we were the very first organisation that put out a social report about ethical sourcing for clothing, which then forced the likes of Nike and Walmart to respond and think about how their products were also sourced. So great moments that just remind you that, yes, it's a business, yes, there's a P&L, but at the end of the day, there's customers and there's, you know, good to be done.
We've had Ian Anderson of the Designers Republic, Sheffield-based but internationally famous business, talking about doing business with international brands, including Coca-Cola, and he said at the end of the day, you're doing business with people.
Mm.
It's about relationships
it
with
is.
People.
That's right.
It's not about necessarily being daunted that they won't buy from you because you're small or whatever. You're doing business. I suppose that resonates with what you said about selling a bottle of Coca-Cola, one bottle at a time as well. In terms of people new to business, trying to build their network and develop their social enterprise, develop their career. One final top tip. Loads of top tips in this, but one final top tip, Penny.
Be bold. Really be bold. People can only say no, but they'll normally say yes.
Fantastic. Penny, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
You're listening to Business Live with me, Jamie Veitch, broadcasting on FM radio, online and as a podcast. That was Penny Hughes. Penny is the chair of the Sustainable Banking Committee at RBS. She was talking with me at the NatWest SE100 Insight event, where social enterprise leaders from all over the UK gathered to inspire one another and to hear from inspirational speakers. Now, one of those speakers was Amy Anslow. Amy and her sister Ruth have founded a social enterprise supermarket in Brighton. They have a vision. They have a very, very clear purpose. What challenges have they faced? Why did they set up the social enterprise in the first place? And what lessons have they learned? What lessons can they pass on to you? We'll hear from Amy now.
Amy Anzo, thanks very much for joining me today. So you've talked here at the SE 100 event in Edinburgh about HISBE, about your social enterprise. Can you just tell our listeners what your social enterprise is and why you set it up?
Yes, it's called HISBE. It stands for How It Should Be, and we're on a mission to reinvent supermarkets for the 21st century. So there are a raft of problems around the current supermarket model, and over the last several decades, the way that supermarkets do business and externalise the cost of the way they do business onto all of us, essentially, is having massive knock-on effects around the food industry, on suppliers, supply chains, farmers, producers. And we simply thought that there was a better way to retail food. So that's what we're about. We're about putting all the good stuff in one place, paying suppliers fairly, paying all staff above the living wage, making access to good, local, affordable food easier for people. We have a pilot store that's been open 18 months in Brighton, and we're now looking at our expansion plan into a regional chain.
So making good local food affordable, are you more expensive than a supermarket, less expensive? How does it compare?
We compare really, really well to supermarket prices. There are certain ways that we can do this. First of all, and most importantly, is we don't take the same margin that supermarkets take on food. So we take a lower margin without hurting the suppliers. And people don't always get how that's possible, because they think the supermarket's as cheap as they can be, but they aren't always. And so on fruit and veg, you can get much cheaper, better quality produce at HISBE that's been sourced locally, helps the local economy, very low use of pesticides, if not up to an organic standard. But crucially, you can buy what you need. So you don't have to buy a kilogram of carrots. You can buy one carrot, and you don't have to buy a whole bag of potatoes. You can buy just the one potato that you wanted for dinner, or the two potatoes that you needed. So we make it much cheaper by trading directly with farmers and producers, but also giving the customer more options on how to buy, and buying unpackaged. And we sell lots of our dry goods unpackaged, so you can buy pasta and rice and seeds and breakfast cereals and chocolate buttons and all manner of other stuff unpackaged, which comes in at a huge saving for the customer, but means that we're not squeezing the supplier either.
Okay, so that all sounds great. And on that issue of suppliers and your relationships with the suppliers, you talked about paying suppliers fairly. Mm-hmm. How does what they get from you compare with what they might get from a large supermarket chain?
Okay, so if you spend a pound in one of the big four, one of Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Tesco, Asda, a pound spent in one of their stores usually equates to between 7 and 10 pence, making it back to the original supplier. In our store, because we can trade directly, around 69 pence in every pound that you spend at HISBE makes it to the supplier. So it's a completely different way of divvying up the cash. So we pay all our staff above the living wage, we pay the suppliers what they deserve to be paid for the food they're producing, and we don't expect to make a huge margin on top. We need to make enough to pay the bills, pay the staff, and a little bit of surplus to continue the social purpose.
So that's a drastic and dramatic difference in terms of around 60 to 69p going to suppliers compared to 7 to 9p. Mm. And in terms of being able to price goods and package goods in different ways so that they are affordable, not making massive margins. Now, some of our listeners will be thinking, this sounds absolutely fantastic, this sounds great, but it's almost alchemy in terms of what you're doing. How can you be financially sustainable? Obviously you are, but is that a big struggle?
Well, we've been open 18 months now. We're consistently in profit. But because of the way that our model works, it's much easier to be financially sustainable, because we're not about making big profits and creating big dividends for the shareholders and the directors. The surplus that we would make if we kept to the same recommended retail prices as other retailers, which we don't. We have a much lower, we sell all our packaged groceries below the RRP, because the RRP has risen so much over the last couple of decades that actually you don't need to make that much to be sustainable if you're not trying to cream off the profits to give away to shareholders. So it's just a very different way of doing business, and buying in bulk and allowing customers to buy as much as they want or as little as they need is one way we can keep down costs. We also have a takeaway coffee bar. The margins on takeaway coffee are quite high. We partnered with Cafe Direct, but when people can afford to buy a nice cup of coffee and a piece of cake, what they're doing is making the food cheaper for everybody, because they're helping us to take some margin there so that we can lower the margin on the food. And we have various little ways within the store of creating additional revenue. We have two areas that we rent out, pods that we rent out to fledgling food businesses, so that they can come in and test with our customers. So it's about being committed to the idea of managing the model differently and finding other ways to create revenue so that we can keep the margins low on the food and make it more affordable for more people.
And what was the biggest challenge, whether the biggest challenge was pre-launch or in the last 18 months since you've been trading? What was the biggest challenge? How did you overcome it?
Well, there's probably one big challenge from before we opened and one big challenge from after we opened.
Let's look at both.
The challenge from before we opened was that we needed to raise $200,000 to open the pilot store, and we were starting from nothing. We were a risky startup. We weren't talking about high rates of return for investors. So we had a real challenge to raise this £200,000, and we knew it needed to be that much because we didn't want to open with a store that looked very spit and sawdust community. We wanted to give the feel that they'd already walked into an existing chain, they just hadn't seen it anywhere yet. So it was really important to us to get it right on the refit, and that's why we were raising quite a large sum for that pilot store. So the first challenge was that, and we succeeded in doing that through a mixture of crowdfunding and local investors, and building a kind of a crowd of people that wanted to see this happen and were prepared to put in smaller or larger amounts of money to help us do it. So that was a big challenge, raising the cash and getting the store open. And after we opened the store, of course, we had to learn how to run a supermarket because we'd not done that before. So there was a period of kind of chaos and adjustment and understanding how orders work. And, you know, we were very clear that we didn't want to waste food. So at the beginning, we were under-ordering and, you know, being cautious so that we weren't ending up with waste, because a lot of the supermarkets will over-order by as much as 50% on fresh, so that it always looks abundant, but they expect to throw that 50% away, and so that is already built into the cost to customer. So there was a lot of challenges in learning how to drive this machine, and we're open 11 hours a day, 7 days a week, so there wasn't much time to kind of sit and breathe. It was about just sort of keeping on the treadmill and figuring it out as we went.
But you obviously have.
Yeah, we're at a good position now. We've been trading 19 months. We've turned over about 1.2 million. We get about 2,700 customers a week. Sales are still rising. The average basket spend is still rising. And crucially, the three directors, myself, my sister Ruth and Jack, we've been able to move away operationally to start work on the expansion plan by transitioning the staff into a self-managing team. So they're all managers and none of them are managers, and they all take responsibility for the running of the shop to free us up to move on to the next bit of the mission.
Lovely story, Amy. Thanks very much for joining me.
Pleasure.
Today. And we're at the SE 100 Leaders event. One tip from you for other leaders of social enterprises.
So one thing that we said in our talk this morning is that it's about putting on your lighthouse and putting that beam out there really strongly. Get out there, tell people what you're doing, get on social media, tell people what you're doing, and people will come to help you. But if you stay in isolation, working away in your, you know, in your back bedroom or whatever, driving yourself crazy trying to get this idea off the ground, it's very, very tough. So start telling everybody and start talking about it, start getting the idea out there, and people will come and lend their time and their resources and their money and their skills to help you make it happen.
Brilliant. Get that lighthouse out there. Well, Amy, thanks for joining me. People who are listening to this show who want to find out more about HISBE can take a look at your website, of course. Do you want to give out the address?
Yeah, it's www.hisbe.co.uk, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're very active on both.
Amy Anslow there of HISBE, a social enterprise supermarket, and Amy talking about the challenges of setting up a social enterprise, but what a clear vision and purpose she has, and talking about being a lighthouse, putting your light out, people will come to you. She talked also about crowdfunding, about securing the finance, about growth and about quality. That was the last of our interviews from the NatWest SE 100 Insight event, which took place last Thursday and Friday in Edinburgh. My thanks to all of our interviewees and participants. It was a great fun event, and there was a lot there for leaders of social enterprises to learn from and to be inspired and to take away. My thanks also, of course, to NatWest for inviting me, to Matter & Co
also co-organisers of the event, and it's worth taking a look at the SE 100 Index yourself. The SE 100 is a market intelligence platform. It tracks the growth and the impact of well over 1,000 social enterprises. You can find it at se100.net.
We're open for business live.
Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. If your business has financial challenges requiring professional insights and solutions, Begbies Trainer can help. We provide advice designed to help people and companies deal successfully with debt and financial problems. And wherever possible, we will find the best solution that allows for active steps towards financial recovery. Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. We're committed to providing a rapid and responsive service based on in-depth experience, professionalism and independent specialist expertise. Contact our Sheffield office on 0114 285 9500 or visit begbies-trainergroup.com.
You've been listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. We've been broadcasting on 93.2 FM and from sheffieldlive.org across Sheffield and the world. This show will also be uploaded to the Sheffield Live website as a podcast later from today. And today's show has included interviews with a number of social enterprise innovators and leaders and with Andy Hanselman. Next up on Sheffield Live is our fantastic folk music programme, so stay tuned to that. That's on from 10 a.m. through to noon, and we're going to play out with a quick track of music, once again, by local band, The Payroll Union.
We're open for Business Live.